Well, welcome all. It's a small gathering, but unfortunately we've got six events on at the same time. But the good thing is we're going to have a question and answer session, so you'll all get an opportunity to be involved. So today we've got a session on housing affordability in Australia. It's been a little bit of a theme at the conference. There have been a few papers on the use of housing in the aged pension, for example. And the topic today is how can actuaries and super funds make a difference? So the two presenters, I've got Luke Kassar from Finity Consulting. He's worked with mortgages before in mortgage insurance, and that's where I think he's developed his interest in this topic. And he's also done a bit of customer analytics, so he'll draw on that today as well. Andrew Doman, who's on council, general manager at Allianz, which is the fourth largest general insurer in Australia. And his background is primarily life and reinsurance work. He's also on the Public Policy Committee at the Institute and chairs the Housing Affordability Working Group. So I'm going to, I think, Luke, you're going to start. Andrew, I got that wrong to start with. And we'll have a very interactive session. I'm going to sit over there so I'm not in the way. And welcome, Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Michael. I always feel a little bit of self-absorption when someone else reads out my bio, knowing that I've written it myself. But, anyway, so we do have an interesting topic. Apologies that it's kind of in the dying stages of the Financial Services Forum, so hopefully we'll keep you awake. We're going to do things a little bit different and try and do an interactive session, so engage the audience for some answers. We are presenting on housing affordability. It's a big topic, a lot of moving parts, but we're going to focus on four key parts and some politically sensitive parts in that as well. Try and approach it impartially and see what the audience's views are on that. So the Actuaries Institute established a Housing Affordability Working Group. Luke and myself are on that group. There's also a few other participants. We've got a good cross-section of consultants, non-consultants, banking, insurance. I'll show you on the next slide who's there. And we are progressing towards writing a green paper on this. And the purpose of today is to get some of the audience's views to make up some of the input for that paper. I mentioned the interactive session and why we're doing it. Now I think we can move on to the next slide. So this is the working group. So we do have quite different experience sets in here, and it does actually give quite a bit of diversity to our discussion that we've had for the last 12 months around this. Okay. So just as a brief agenda, I'm going to start off with probably the least interesting of the four points up there, with talking a bit about why we're doing this, what actuaries have to offer in the housing affordability arena. Then I'm going to pass over to Luke, and he's going to take you through some analytics and charts to ask you to put to you the question: do you think Australia has a housing affordability problem? We're then going to go into the demand side, and then focus particularly on one component of demand, and that's quite politically sensitive. I'll then step up again and come into the supply issues and again talk about one particular supply mechanism and engage you again to see what your ideas are on that. So just quickly covering off on motivation for why we think actuaries have something to offer in this area. So the Actuaries Institute and actuaries in general, we've done a lot of work acting in the public interest. We're generally quite independent and quite good at managing things where there's fair and equitable outcomes for different stakeholders. So I think that has a lot to offer, especially in comparison to other subject matter experts that often comment on housing affordability. Housing affordability, as I mentioned at the start, is quite a complex topic. There's a lot of moving parts. It influences quite a lot of things out there. And actuaries in general, we're of the view that you can break apart these very complex things and then solve them bit by bit and communicate them to both the technical and non-technical audience. Finally, we have a lot of focus on retirement incomes, long-term outcomes of retirement incomes, and housing is not independent from retirement incomes in our view. we see it as a key component of retirement, and we'll cover off on some of that during the talk. So here's just a couple of the most recent sort of public policy papers that we've done. Some of them actually do touch on housing wealth and also retirement incomes, but also to show you that just in general we're acting in the public interest, and therefore housing affordability, we have something to say in that aspect. Does anyone have any comments about this less interesting topic, or can we move on to the better ones? Yep, all agreed. Over to you, Luke.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. So the next part we're going to talk about is, well, firstly, does Australia actually have a housing affordability problem? Is this a problem that warrants a response from our state or federal level governments? Is it worth making different policy measures in order to get a different outcome? Now, just to reiterate, we are using the live polls that are on the app. There will be a question come up during this section, and it'd be great to see you kind of respond to that, and we'll review the results at the end of each section. So when we first started getting into this problem, we realised we had to actually define housing affordability and what the problem was that we're trying to tackle. Because if you look at some of the research that's currently out there, there's multiple facets of housing affordability that you can look into. At a first glance, you could think of it as a household's ability to pay for the cost of housing. But there are many sides to that, or many aspects of that kind of concept. So the first being, are we talking about first home buyers being able to enter the property market? Are we talking about existing homeowners being able to upsize when their household requirements change? Are we talking about mortgage serviceability and housing stress, being able to service your mortgage as circumstances change and interest rates change? Are we talking about rental affordability, so specifically looking at renters and being able to pay rent? Or are we talking about housing for low-income earners, often referred to as affordable housing? Additionally, you have to consider that housing affordability is driven by a vast range of different factors. So you've got social factors such as the kind of great Australian dream to own one's own home as opposed to renting, economic, political factors and demographic factors such as the changing kind of average household size and also average time at which people have children, being later in life than previously. It's also important to consider that affordability of housing may change across geographical region as well. So clearly housing affordability has been a topic for when considering capital cities like Sydney and Melbourne, but certainly in certain regions of the country, housing affordability, you could argue, has actually improved for those areas, particularly places like mining towns that, you know, for certain reasons have seen declining housing house prices. But for the purposes of today, and while our Green paper may look to incorporate a lot more of these kind of facets, for the purposes of today, we're mostly looking at we're basically defining housing affordability to be around first home buyers trying to enter the property market and their ongoing ability to service a mortgage once entering that market. So we've put together this survey question. So this is the one on the app. I think it's you'll find it in concurrent 9E question 1. So considering potential first home buyers, does Australia have a housing affordability problem? No, possibly, but affordability has not really changed over time. It's allowing for interest rate effects. Yes, but only in some capital cities. And then yes, overarching, we have to do something about it kind of everywhere. So I'm going to take you through a few exhibits just to kind of that may contribute to your view, and we'll review the results of the survey question at the end. So as part of the group, we've been looking at a number of different measures. There's different ways you can measure housing affordability. One of the most simple ones is the house price to income ratio. So what we're showing on the graph here is the house price to income ratio indexed to what it was back in 1987. So that's why 1987, it's 100. So what you can see up to the end of 2017, is that that ratio has doubled since 1987. Now, it's an imperfect measure. It's got limitations. Obviously, it doesn't take into account the fact that interest rates have changed quite considerably during that time. So most notably, from 2012 to now, interest rates have declined. And, of course, that means that servicing that debt may actually be, in fact, better or not as worse as the actual rate at which the house prices increase. However, this is... We are using this basically as a measure of the ability to save for a deposit. So what it's showing is that as a multiple of your income, the deposit required is increasing. The trend's not unique to Australia. So looking at our neighbours, which are quite comparable to Australia, Canada's seen a similar kind of increase, although maybe not as extreme. New Zealand's seen a much more severe increase in recent times. The UK has increased, although not to the extent that New Zealand, Australia or Canada has. And the US is different. They've actually been, based on this measure, it's been relatively flat. Although we do attribute that to the US has a far greater proportion of arable land. Probably urbanisation isn't as big as it is in Australia. There's a larger number of large cities with employment opportunities to choose from in the US. Although there are certainly examples in the US of cities that are having quite dramatic rises in house price to income ratios, like San Francisco. So even within geographical regions, this problem does occur everywhere. Just to reiterate that point around interest rates and their impact on scheduled repayments. So this is a graph that the RBA published only a few months ago. So on the left, you've got the debt to income ratio, which has been increasing over the last couple of decades. But over on the right, if you look at that purple line, that's the total scheduled repayments as a proportion of income. And since 2007, that's actually come down. So what it's saying is that while there's maybe a higher barrier to entry into the property market, once you're in there, the actual cost of servicing that debt is around the same. Now, it also may not... It doesn't necessarily capture all things, so it may be that the scheduled repayments have been about flat, but it could be that households aren't actually paying off more of a buffer. Maybe they're paying less of a buffer over their scheduled repayment anyway. Another simple measure of looking at housing affordability is the home ownership rates themselves. So taken from the ABS census in 2006 and 2011 and 2016, we've looked at rates of home ownership for households. So the dark blue line is the proportion of households that own their home outright, and that's been declining. The proportion that own with a mortgage has increased slightly, but the largest increase is coming in at the proportion that are renting. So what we've also found is that this kind of statistic is holds reasonably true across most or all income levels. So it's not necessarily something that's impacting lower incomes, it's impacting higher incomes too, that home ownership is declining in those areas. There are notable declines, more so in younger and middle-aged households of home ownership. When you compare it over those, so the same age group over from 2006 to 2016, and what we've also found is there's not too much difference between metropolitan households and regional households, so it's not necessarily an issue that's confined to capital cities, but there are also regional centres that are facing similarly declining levels of housing affordability. Now, we have looked at other measures as well. I won't go through each of these. There's numerous research that goes through different ways of measuring housing affordability. There's none that really say this is the definitive measure of housing affordability, but they all kind of capture different aspects of it. You can see mostly we're seeing red, which is suggesting that most measures are generally saying there's a declining housing affordability, but there are pockets of green. For instance, the proportion of first home buyers has actually been increasing in Western Australia, as well as in Victoria after some state government initiatives. So now it'd be interesting to see what our survey results are.
Hopefully more than two people voted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we might actually do a show of hands if we don't get enough responses. I don't know what that is, but... Adobe always needs to update. Okay, so saying 80% have said yes. Could I invite anyone that did say yes to share why they saw this as a problem? Or anyone that said no, particularly the blanket response?
I said no, Richard Lyon. I said no based on the question and the reference to interest rates. Mm-hmm. So you just passed off, well, interest rates, particularly in the last few years. 1987, interest rates were about 18%. Mm-hmm. So actually a doubling is quite an impressive result, given that they're now 5%. I do actually think there are all kinds of housing affordability problems, but as a general blanket question, it is rational, the price at the moment. If you came to my session, you'll know why.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does anyone have a rebuttal or you know, contrarian view to now that we've like, yeah, there's a, yeah. Okay, so now I need to get back to... Okay, so we're just going to talk around, I guess the rest of it does assume, like, if there is a housing affordability problem, what can we do to actually address it? So, you know, we've talked, there's kind of issues or responses you can do on the demand side and issues and responses you can do on the supply side. So we've kind of come out with a number of the demand pressure points. You know, some of the kind of causes for what's causing maybe a high proportion of house prices to incomes are, you know, you have a concentration of employment in capital cities. You also have net migration to Australia and its capital cities. Access to credit can be a demand pressure point. That's not to say that it has been recently, particularly with APRA's macroprudential controls have actually seen lending growth come back, and so that's kind of going that way. Also, the kind of great Australian dream to own a home or kind of an aversion to renting in Australia, as well as tax policy. And this covers a vast array of kind of aspects. There's access to superannuation, which, if you like, is a subsidy, a tax subsidy, because you're being taxed at a lower rate. Capital gains relief, negative gearing that applies to investment properties, as well as asset test eligibility in the aged pension. So we're going to just touch on one aspect of this demand side issue, and that is the access to superannuation, because it has been quite a topic of interest in the past, although probably potentially politically unpopular at the moment. So the next survey question is, should first home buyers be allowed to use a portion of superannuation for a housing deposit? You know, the responses ranging from no, it'll drive up house prices, no, a firm belief that superannuation should be for retirement income only, both A and B, yes, but with limits, so caps on the amount that you can contribute and withdraw from superannuation, or make it restricted to certain income levels, or a blanket yes. You know, superannuation is your own money and should be used as you wish, as long as it goes into a certain investment or whichever. So that's the question. We'll go through a couple of thoughts and discussion points and then come back and have a look at the results. So just to the current situation, I can't quite remember when it was, but recently the government announced the kind of a first home super saver scheme. So $30,000 can be saved in the superannuation fund at a 15% concessional tax rate, as long as it goes towards the purchase of the first home. Just having a look internationally, we sort of try to find other examples where, you know, compulsory superannuation could be withdrawn to pay for a first home. Now, there aren't an enormous number of examples where there is, you know, where similar kind of countries to Australia have compulsory superannuation. For example, New Zealand, while they allow withdrawals from their kind of superannuation scheme to purchase property, that superannuation scheme in itself is opt-out, and you don't have to participate in that. But they do allow specifically, but if you were to be part of that scheme, you can only make a withdrawal to purchase property until you reach retirement age. Singapore is a little bit of a different example. It's a much more, I guess, socialised program where they've implemented a compulsory savings scheme, but those savings go towards both like all of retirement income, your own healthcare, and your housing needs. And those rates of saving are quite high. You know, at some ages, at about 37% of income in total. Switzerland, which I think it's maybe through a portion of their pension scheme, you can it does allow the sale of some of their pension assets through your employer program, as long as it goes to a home purchase or an improvement in your current home as an owner-occupier. So that's not even extended just to first home buyers. It's basically for any kind of home improvement purpose or home purchase for an owner-occupier. Obviously, there are positives and negatives to kind of any kind of policy measure, but looking at some of the positives, you allow easier entry into the property market for first home buyers. It'll increase kind of home ownership rates for that segment. And what we found is that generally retirement assets are greater for those that are property owners at retirement than they are for renters. So that this is kind of where we get into the link to retirement incomes, that if you're an owner-occupier when you retire, you'll kind of have a better... you're in a better financial position than those that are renters, historically, anyway. Obviously, some of the negatives are that it increases demand and will just push up house prices anyway, and therefore it's kind of self-defeating. Also, you may have that there's this kind of intergenerational shift in tax concessions, and that you're benefiting one part of the population at the expense of others. There's obviously considerations for how it would work. For example, what would happen to the proceeds of sales? So let's say you saved up $30,000 for your in your superannuation account, withdrew it for a home purchase. 10 years later, you sell that home. Are you then free to use those funds, or should that portion that you saved in superannuation be deposited back into superannuation? You also need to make sure people aren't kind of gaming this system and you don't have unintended consequences and that you're targeting first home buyers appropriately. So we're going to reflect now on the survey results, and I'll then probably pass it to you guys to kind of for a bit of discussion. Okay, so it looks like it's a pretty mixed response. So 40% are saying no. And generally it's for both reasons. 60% are saying yes. Anyone want to share their views on or justifications? Do you have a view, Michael?
Yeah. So my view is that we say that adequacy is not good enough in retirement already. So the moment you start diverting money out of the system, if the SG isn't good enough, then there's a real danger that those people may start owning a home, but their super balances are going to be lower. Mm. And I think that it's a good discipline for people to have to learn to save money themselves. The super saving is forced on them. 30,000 isn't going to be enough, so they are certainly going to have to supplement that. Mm-hmm. But I just think it'd be easier for super funds to use their bargaining power to give cheaper mortgages to people if you want a mechanism for helping. That's just my view.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my hand back to. Or
must be able to get somebody to say yes.
Michael said yes.
You said kind of.
I selected B, and I think it's thinking about, well, there's all these tax concessions in the superannuation environment. Were they intended to cover non-retirement reasons? And I think the other aspect is part of the glory of superannuation is the power of compound interest and how you can use that to get a really big retirement income in the future. So if you start taking up to 30K out of your balance, then you're really losing that power.
Rationally, I should have said yes, because I'm in a position where at some time in the relatively near future, I'll be downsizing. I'll be selling my home, and I would love to have house prices driven up, because from where they are now, probably flat or a little bit down, particularly in the Sydney market, is the likely direction. But I said C, for the reason that it would drive up house prices. I think that always happens. Mm. Super is for income in retirement. And on top of that, people do game the system. My son's friend gamed the system. We knew it was happening. We helped him. My son actually paid him some rent so he could have his 6 months living in the property to count as a first home buyer. These things happen.
Mm-hmm. I voted yes, because I think owning a house is a legitimate asset for retirement, particularly if you develop the mortgage release, what we call home equity release type market. Then you've got an orderly method by which you can draw down the equity and provide yourself with income in retirement, which addresses the point that you made about it should be for income in retirement. It's a legitimate asset, and you have it in the system rather than out.
Yep, good point.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I said C. The only additional reason was that once you open up the superannuation egg, there's no telling what you're forced to use for. That's a material risk.
Yeah. I said yes, mainly because there's a view, isn't it? There's a problem. So 8 out of 10 said there was a problem. given that was an option, then to address that problem, I think it's worth looking at. If there are other better options out there, then potentially that would be better. I appreciate that accessing super is not a great idea at a young age, which is partly why there's been issues around changing super rules just recently. But the subject to no other option, then it would be worth consideration. But if there are better options out there, then let's look at those.
That's good.
Just one of the views we heard as well against A, so about at least initially driving up house prices, is that if we didn't have superannuation, is this just a return to the norm of what property prices would be had we not fought mandated super saving for people who've been purchasing anyway?
So you mean they're low?
Sorry?
House prices are low because of super.
That's one view we've heard.
Hmm.
It's one way to think about it, I guess.
He has a 10 vote, I think so.
I voted in A, no, but it doesn't seem to be recorded for something.
You pressed the wrong button.
But it's just based on my own personal experience of buying a property a few years ago, when the young couples that were bidding seemed to have parents behind them, and the price went higher because they had parental support. It'll go even higher if they can also draw some of their money from the super fund. It'll just be a transfer of wealth from the home buyers to the house sellers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll probably head over to Andrew now to go into the next part, which is around the supply issues.
Thanks, Luke. Very interesting points. Hopefully I can get some interesting points as well. Okay, so we're going to start similar to the demand side and just cover some of the pressure points on the supply side. So planning and development rules, density policies, seems to be quite a key one that we hear about sort of restricting supply, particularly in Sydney, or at least something we've heard recently about. Incentives to downsize or disincentives, depending on how you look at the asset test. Including tax policy, the desire to decentralise or lack thereof, and the supporting infrastructure for decentralised employment or work from home, remote work, whatever you want to call it. And then subsequently, concentration in major cities or so-called land locking.
So we're going to focus on one key controversial question here again. Let's see if we can get some voices on that, which is the incentives or disincentives to downsize. Okay, so the survey question, which I've skipped over here, should we be doing more to encourage retirees to downsize with the aim to increase the supply of suitable housing? So no, it would not materially improve the supply. No, it could be unfair to retirees. Yes, but by limiting the age pension asset test exemption. It's quite a long way of saying it, but yep. Yes, but use other incentives such as land tax, replacing stamp duty. There's other things as well, what we're referring to there, which is sort of subsidising through tax for the income that would come out of downsizing. Yes, with a combination of C and D. So get on your voting polls. So we're going to talk about some of the arguments for and some of the arguments against, just to give it an impartial view on that. So the main argument for that we see is that there's a fair bit of space out there. If you look at sort of predominantly most places have at least more than one bedroom spare, as you can see from the chart there. And at least in theory, if you forget logistics and sort of people's feelings on moving and stuff like that, it means that there's space available there that could increase supply. So let's have a think about sort of the current stick and carrot, at least from the tax perspective. So at the moment, the age pension asset test exempts the own home. And effectively what that means is that anyone having a pension, I'm hoping to say this right, anyone that has a pension is basically not incentivized to downsize, because as soon as they sell that, that income will then be counted as an asset for them and will be curb effectively their pension that they'll be able to receive. So I guess that we could, if we tried to change that, we could either cap or completely remove the exemption for the own home, and that cap could take the form various ways. It could be an indexed cap, it could change by city region, it could be sort of tailored in some ways. And there's a carrot element to it as well you could implement, which basically say, okay, the proceeds from downsizing, if it's invested in something that is superannuation related, then we'll give it a tax benefit. So they're not, whilst they're two separate things, you could look at them both in duality in terms of implementation. And let's talk a little bit about the impact of that, but focusing on the negatives, I guess, firstly. So a recent report by the Grattan Institute was heavily against any policy measures to downsize, and they argued it on the basis of these three points here, effectively saying that in the current form of the age pension asset test, that has the unintended consequence of... So firstly, hang on, I'll say, so we've already got up to $300,000 that you could basically get a tax advantage for from downsizing. But they're saying that basically that targets the wrong people, because anyone that has a pension will not do that, because, or has a significant amount of their income being a pension, will not do that, because as soon as they sell it, that up to $300,000 will then count against their assets, and therefore they'll reduce their pension. So the people that will likely get benefit from that thing up the top will effectively be probably richer people that are not earning a pension. So you're effectively diverting tax benefits to them. Nonetheless, still potentially boosting supply. They also focus on the emotional cost of retirees and why they sort of would make this decision in the first place. There was actually a statistic written in there saying two-thirds of older Australians, the desire to age in place is the most important reason for not selling the family home. So that goes to number two. Number three, which is slightly related, is more around logistically. If they wanted to sell, they might want to sell and stay in the same neighbourhood because of, I don't know, family or whatever other sentimental things that have been built up. However, a lot of our established suburbs are sort of we're not able to implement subdivision, and therefore it's hard to sort of downsize within that same suburb, and therefore you'd have to move further out. So a bit of a logistical issue there. So that's the negative side, and the Grattan report was actually quite strong on that, which I found quite interesting. So back to the survey question. Now that you've heard the positive side and the negative side, can we see how that went? Okay. All right. Quite reasonably unanimous, I'd say. Yes, by limiting the aged pension asset test exemption and also using other incentives with 80%. Is anyone brave enough to say why they said C and not E? Anyone from the E bucket want to step up and talk about it a little bit further? So just so I fully understand what you're saying, why are they leaving? Are they running out of income effectively, or are they just...
They're going to draw down all their assets at some stage. They're going to draw down all their assets at some stage.
Yep.
Family home is just one of those assets.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't make sense for them to stay in a great big house.
Yep.
Plus, while they don't think about this, particularly as they get older, more than likely they will have to move into aged care anyway. They're going to have to leave the house anyway. So I'm saying... It's an unachievable objective that I'm going to live in my grandparents' family house until I die at 92. That happens very rarely for people, because most of them don't have the health and they have to go into aged care anyway.
Yeah, that report wasn't the Grattan Institute's finest hour.
Okay.
It really wasn't. To put up as reasons not to give incentives to downsize the very barriers that you've got to overcome, that's a nonsense. That's why incentives are needed. The fact that you're emotionally attached to the house that you're in, the fact that the suburb might not have enough accommodation of the right type for you, that's exactly what you've got to overcome. So there was only one legitimate reason there, which was the age pension. And the others were just reasons why you need your incentive.
No, fair enough. It's
as to staying in your own home, my parents are still in the big house they've had for... well over 20 years, 24 years, and my siblings back in the UK keep trying to get them to move somewhere more sensible. They're out miles away from any major city, miles away from decent hospitals, all of that, and no go.
So do they, if you don't mind me asking, do they draw a pension?
No.
Okay.
The
I was going to test the politically sensitive thing.
It's a company pension.
Okay, all right. They're not government, okay.
Yeah, it's not government. It's not tied to that.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just that emotional attachment is huge. But it's something that's got to be overcome. You've got that spare space. And as an owner of a house with more rooms than we now need, the interesting thing is you start to say, well, that's a study now, and that's a this room, and that's a that room.
You invent reasons.
They're all
veterans together. Well, and the other thing they do is they say we're keeping it for when the kids come to visit.
Yeah.
So that's one day a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Christmas, absolutely. Yeah.
So Andrew, if I could just add to that, I
agree
with Richard. Maybe people would move downsize at the time they retire, when they're active and probably more likely to make a decision. But the transaction costs are very high, and the fact that, you know, if you're drawing a pension, you're going to get penalised. So I think both together do count. The ACT, as you know, is replacing stamp duty gradually with a land tax. And what that will do in time is will mean that rates will be high. And then people might say, we've got this four-bedroom house, we're paying 10 grand a year in rates instead of two. Is it still worth us paying that? Because it's a big part of our income. So I think that's definitely something that would be beneficial. And I spoke yesterday on the age pension and said I think we should recognise that a significant part of the family home is now actually an investment. You know, that years and years ago, if you go back to the 70s, I think the average house price in Sydney and Melbourne was about 2.5 times average earnings. So it was affordable and most people could get it, particularly with two incomes. Now where it's 10 to 12 times, a big part of that is really, you'd have to say, is part of their investment portfolio. And you'll need to change the age pension assets test to get people to be able to move.
If you go back a couple of slides to that chart,
can I?
Too many, too few bedrooms. Yeah, I know.
Alt tab.
This is beyond my capability.
We're going so well until we try to get backwards.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Go back. Yeah, right. Yeah. So forward to that. So if you look at that chart and you look at the difference between the owned outright, which is I've had my home for ages, I've paid off my mortgage, and the renter, I'm actually choosing where I'm going to live based on affordability, you can see that people don't choose to have too much space in their house if they have to pay for it. But if they get it for free, well, why not?
I think interesting view that you think we're just basically delaying the inevitable if we don't make any changes out of that.
Yeah.
Obviously quite political to change the asset pension test. So,
Andrew, it's not just the age pension, it's the fact that we have no capital gains tax on family homes, nor are there any debt duties. So it's actually in the family's interest to hold on to that asset and let it appreciate. And because of migration, shortage of land, and other factors, it's almost guaranteed to go up because of the supply demand equation which you've shown.
Okay. Any other points? How are we going for time?
We're about 6 minutes.
Any other points? Final comments?
I think anything that, any directions you think we should kind of look into as well, like to not just looking at superannuation or the kind of downsizing incentives, but some areas we've acknowledged that as actuaries we may not have expertise to comment in urban planning or anything like that, but if there are other kind of views that are worth us looking into.
I'd be interested to see if you, like Melbourne and Sydney now, almost global cities where the property prices are perhaps much higher than the rest of the country. It'd be interesting to know if outside those two cities the same statistics provide.
Well, Adelaide's much cheaper. Perth follows the mining cycle.
Yeah.
Brisbane's probably about on the national average.
We have done some work around that as well.
Yeah, and looking kind of globally as well, you can say Auckland and San Francisco are probably the two cities that have, like, based on house price measures, have been probably worse than Sydney, but you've also, I guess, Hong Kong, New York, and those kind of big guys are worse than Sydney, but like it does look a bit funny when you see the top 20 measures and Sydney is sitting right up there, and you don't necessarily think of it among the likes of London and New York. But there's certainly cities of similar size that have a similar issue.
I think one of the things that clouds the whole affordability question is you think of, in my case, I think of my kids buying a house, and I know that they can't buy a house anywhere near where my house is. Not for years and years and years and years. But then, that's not where I bought first either. But they've got to go that much further out of the city, that much further away from, well, at least if you're working in in the centre of Sydney. But that's always happened. It's just, it feels worse now. So where I live, when we moved in there 27 years ago, the house next door was the first house that had been built on the street, and it was still lived in by the widow of the couple who had built the house. And when they built the house, it was a release of farming land. Now, the suburb is Gordon. You don't think of Gordon as
going to release
the
land.
The city and farming land. But that's the way it goes. And our kids will have the same stories about, I don't know, somewhere out beyond Central Coast maybe, but it'll be the same sort of thing. You wouldn't believe that this was once on the fringe.
Well, they'll live in apartments.
Yeah. Well, they'll live in apartments, and that's the other thing.
My sons grew up in Asia, and we lived in apartments all the time, and my two boys hate the idea that they'll have a house with a garden. And all they're interested in is a townhouse or a high-rise level apartment. So I think there is some cultural change going on, that while some of my nieces and nephews went all the way out to get an affordable home, others are quite happy to have something of a smaller scale in but a more expensive location. I mean, the dollars work out to be about the same. One person pays just for location, not space. The other one pays for space, not the location.
Now just quickly, so Luke touched on the Great Australian Dream and also just quickly on the low appetite for renting. So one thing that we're looking into as well is why Australia is so different to some of the other countries on long-term renting. So countries like... That's exactly the thing. So it's around rent controls and lease controls. So somewhere like Germany where you have long-term renting, it's very much in the favour of the renter versus the landlord. So we've compiled some comparisons on that as well. We didn't show them today because it was probably a little bit out of the direction of where we were going. But, that's another interesting one, and it goes to that sort of demand element there as to what's the future generations going to want rather than a backyard with three bedrooms or whatever it is.
If you can leverage some work on that, that would be really good. Very valuable.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Andrew and Luke. I'd encourage you all to put in the presenter feedback. I think this is quite a valuable topic for actuaries in a number of areas, pensions, social change, and who knows, even how we plan our cities one day. But would you please join me and thank Luke and Andrew for their presentations.